Now.
On News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. Glad to have you with us on a holiday weekend. Jeff Wolf behind the console, as usual. Jane Houghton, our producer. The story that will be dominating the headlines for the remainder of the day and the weekend will be the release of the list of the Mar-a-Lago documents. Bigger fish to fry in the world right now, but that seems to be the one the media likes to talk about, and obviously the Democrats like to talk about. So I guess we should run this down for you a little bit, and then we'll get into the president's speech, if you want to call it a speech. We'll get to that in a couple minutes. But what they're saying now is the Justice Department has released the list of what they took from Mar-a-Lago. Over 10,000 U.S. government documents and photographs without classification markings. That's the unsealed Justice Department inventory. Now, there were folders, four dozen empty folders that were marked return to staff secretary / military aide. The government has not publicly indicated it believes any classified documents are missing. So that's one positive there, I guess, for the former president. 11,179 documents and photos without classification markings. Now, they were found mixed in with classified material in the boxes and containers in Trump's office and in a storage room. Now, here's an interesting take. Business Insider had this story, and just for sake of argument, you know, devil's advocate here a little bit. They say in the chaos after the 2020 election, White House aides were secretly packing Trump's boxes. Ex-Trump officials told the New York Times they didn't recall classified material going into the boxes. Obviously, Trump was not as cautious as other presidents in handling sensitive material. Now, why were the aides packing the boxes like that? This is the kicker. Aides were frantically and secretly packing the president's things behind his back at the end of his presidency because Trump insisted he would not be leaving the White House after the 2020 election. That according to a report by the New York Times. That's just an interesting perspective on this. So you're going to hear about the documents. It is what it is, and the investigation will proceed, and the Justice Department will likely seek an indictment, and he'll likely be tried in a D.C. court. And we all know where that's going to end up, but that's down the road. Let's turn to something probably more relevant to all of us, and that is the president's speech the other night, because it sets the tone for the country. The temperature in the country has been quite high recently. You may recall that there were many reports that the former president, Donald Trump, had reached out to Merrick Garland, our attorney general, several weeks ago to say, what can I do to bring the temperature down? That was the former president. Well, the current president turned the temperature up significantly on Thursday night. Now, it took him a little bit of time to get warmed up. He had a little rough spot coming out of the box. This is a cut one.
Fellow Americans, please, if you have a seat, take it. I speak to you tonight from sacred ground in America, Independence Hall in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Oh, he finally got going. It takes a little time to warm up sometimes, just like the Saturday morning show. It got pretty rough. Now, you've probably seen and heard bits and pieces of it, but this was significant, and this was something that was billed by the White House in advance that it would not be a political speech. That was clearly misinformation, and I'll say that to be polite. But here are just some samples of what the president had to say about MAGA supporters.
We must be honest with each other and with ourselves. Too much of what's happening in our country today is not normal. Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic. But there's no question that the Republican Party today is dominated, driven, and intimidated by Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans. And that is a threat to this country. And here, in my view, is what is true.
It got pretty brutal if you're a Republican or a MAGA Republican.
And here, in my view, is what is true. MAGA Republicans do not respect the Constitution. They do not believe in the rule of law. MAGA forces are determined to take this country backwards. Backwards to an America where there is no right to choose, no right to privacy, no right to contraception, no right to marry who you love.
So I like that line about too much of what's happening today is not normal, like inflation, like crime, like gas prices. We could go on that list, but we'll stick with his speech. And he continued to, try and unite the country here.
They promote authoritarian leaders and they fan the flames of political violence. MAGA Republicans look at America and see carnage and darkness and despair. They spread fear and lies. Lies told for profit and power.
He just went on and on and on, and it was a rant. It was kind of funny, you know. It had been billed as a big primetime speech, right? So I'm figuring, well, let's see a speech on NBC. So I tune in, speech time on NBC, and they're in the 20-something season of Law & Order. I figure, well, let's go down to the Fox network, and I'm sure it's a primetime speech. It'll probably be there on Fox 5, won't it? No, it was Penn State versus Purdue. Well, let's move over to ABC 7. It was season 4 of Press Your Luck. And then I figure, well, CBS, I mean, you know, CBS is always kind of traditionally tended to support Democrats, liberal causes. Well, I was treated to Young Sheldon over at CBS. Tucker Carlson opted to do his own show and just sort of characterize the speech as we went along. So you're kind of limited, your C-SPANs, your CNNs, and your MSNBCs. But the networks, which I thought was just really interesting, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, opted not to air the speech in prime time. Well, there were some prime responses to President Biden's speech, one of them from Nikki Haley. And if you haven't heard it, I think it sums up the way I feel. And once you hear it, it may very well sum up the way you feel. That is next. But first, Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
So far, so good on the Beltway, both in Virginia and in Maryland. I looked at the cameras around the Beltway, inner loop and outer loop, no crashes or construction. In Virginia on 66 in Fairfax County, you're at speed on the eastbound side and on the westbound side. On 95 in Virginia, between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, go ahead and set your cruise control. Lanes are wide open, northbound or southbound. In Prince George's County, between the two Beltways, on the BW Parkway or 95, no crashes or construction. Lanes are clear, and you'll be at the posted speed limit there as well. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly sunny, hot, and more humid. The start of the Labor Day weekend. Highs today around the 90-degree mark. We'll have some filtered sunshine at times, and definitely you'll notice that added mugginess. Lows back into the 60s and 70s tonight under partly cloudy skies for your Sunday. Partly sunny, again hot and humid. Highs near 90 degrees. Can't rule out a stray storm, mainly into the mountains. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the First Alert Weather Center.
It's 70 degrees in the nation's capital, 620 on the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is the Saturday morning update as we look ahead to the midterms of 2022 and then, of course, the presidential in 2024. A lot of scuttlebutt, obviously, talk about who's going to run on the Republican side. Is it going to be Rick Scott? Is it going to be Ron DeSantis? Obviously, former President Trump in the mix. How about Nikki Haley? Former governor of South Carolina, former UN ambassador, and she was very succinct, and I think she speaks for many of us as she reviewed the president's speech.
It was one of the most unbelievable things I've seen in a long time. He looked like he was in the depths of hell. He's got military uniform, military officers behind him, which I hate that they even had to sit behind him as he was talking about how half the country are basically domestic terrorists. We are not extremists just because we want our kids to be able to ride their bike down the street and not worry about something happening to them. We're not extremists because they're parents who want to make sure that their kids learn the basics and not have to worry about what pronoun they're being called behind their back. We're not extremists because we think that all of this illegal activity crossing the border does matter and that rule of law does matter. We're not extremists just because we see how distracted this administration is and how more dangerous the world is becoming. You know, around as we watch things, we're not extremists because we're struggling to be able to afford groceries and not necessarily have the child care. It's unthinkable that he would be so condescending and criticize half of America for just wanting our country to go back to where it was, when the economy was good, when streets were safe, when the rule of law mattered. The idea that he condemned us was worse than Hillary calling us deplorables, was worse than Obama calling us extremists. He basically called us bad people. Yeah. And that's not a president I want. I don't think that's a president most Americans want. In a time where we're looking at how divided our country is, we are begging for things to go back to normal. And Joe Biden just proved he's the last person that's ever going to help us get things back to normal. It's why these races in November matter. It's why every one of us needs to show up. And it's why we need to show him that just because we're Americans that appreciate the good of our country doesn't make us bad.
So I want to get some response from Caitlin Collins of CNN. They had a CNN roundtable. Here's what Caitlin Collins said. She's White House correspondent at CNN. This is what she had to say right after the speech.
I think a reaction coming out of it that the White House is pushing back on is the idea that this was a purely political speech. They're saying it's not political because he's making an argument about democracy. But when you look at the speech, it did have a political bent to it. He was making clear that he thinks that these Republicans should not be elected into office. He was talking about come November that he wants voters to go to the polls and reject these Republicans, reject this extremism as he framed it. And one thing about the speech is they had been thinking about doing this for a while. This is something that we are told by sources President Biden had wanted to do since earlier this summer. It's notable they picked this timing because they said it wasn't a speech about Trump. He did name drop him a lot, which is notable for Biden, someone who often tries not to name Trump. But it came, you know, we're not that far away from the midterm elections. We've got a few weeks to go, and they really wanted to make it a referendum in that sense.
So that's some sense of response to the president's speech and obviously the unifying speech itself. Coming up on the program today, Jennifer Harper will follow the 6:30 news. And with Jennifer, we've got some interesting poll numbers that don't show the president exactly out of the tank. I was going to say something else, but we'll just call it the tank. That's some interesting numbers there, and also some very interesting rating numbers for Greg Gutfeld. And this is pretty fascinating. And if you watch Gutfeld, you're going to want to hear the news on this if you haven't heard it already. We'll also be talking with Jim Trusty, of course, a legal advisor. He's been with us for quite a while, and he's coming up, and we'll sum up some of the week's activities in the Mar-a-Lago investigation and the defense. Also coming up, we will be talking with John Gizzi, and John will give us the rundown on the speech from his perspective. Also, what happened in Alaska? Sarah Palin lost? How did that happen? Well, there's an explanation behind that. John's got it for us. And he will look back on the life of Mikhail Gorbachev and the very important role he played in Russia and in the history of the world in the late 20th century. That's coming up. We've also got Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. KT McFarland will be along. And a quick program note that Cheryl Atkinson will return from her summer production schedule. She'll be back with us next Saturday. So it's all coming up on the Saturday Morning Update. In the news at 6:30, FBI agents who searched former President Trump's Florida home last month found dozens of folders marked classified, but with nothing inside and no explanation of what might have been in there. They also recovered more than 10,000 government records with no classification marking. That's according to the more detailed inventory of the seized material that was made public by the Justice Department on Friday. The former president will travel to Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania today. Donald Trump holding his first rally of the general election season. He has notched a long list of wins in GOP primaries over the summer, but a number of the candidates he elevated have not done as well in the polling recently against their Democratic candidates. Puts control of the Senate, once assumed to be a lock for Republicans, on the line. It is a high-stakes situation for President Trump as he lays the groundwork for an expected 2024 presidential run amid a series of escalating legal challenges, including the FBI's recent seizure of those classified documents from his club at Mar-a-Lago. It's 6:33. It is the Saturday morning update, and Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
Good morning. On the Maryland side of the Beltway in Prince George's County and in Montgomery County, nothing in the road is going to slow you down. In Montgomery County on 270, between the Beltway and Frederick, northbound and southbound lanes are clear. In Prince George's County, between the two Beltways, on the BW Parkway or 95, I don't have any reports of anything in the roadway to slow you down. If you go into the Bay Bridge, head over to the Eastern Shore for the Labor Day weekend. At the Bay Bridge, currently two lanes are headed east and three lanes are coming west. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly sunny, hot, and more humid to the start of the Labor Day weekend. Highs today of around the 90-degree mark. We'll have some filtered sunshine at times, and definitely you'll notice that added mugginess. Lows back in the 60s and 70s tonight under partly cloudy skies for your Sunday. Partly sunny, again hot and humid. Highs near 90 degrees. Can't rule out a stray storm, mainly into the mountains. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the First Alert Weather Center.
It's 70 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:34 on the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9
WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jennifer Harper joins us. She writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Rick.
Another interesting week for President Biden, attacking 50% of the country pretty handily Thursday night. There's another nickname for the president floating around out there.
Yes, indeed, there is, and it's called the absentee president. This is kind of a handy little term, has sort of emerged at an opportune time, certainly as we're thinking about the final vacation of summer. But anyway, there are a lot of voters and several news organizations who are out there kind of monitoring President Biden's frequent absences from the White House these days, and they're paying attention to the actual numbers, doing a little math. And this week it was hotair.com that was following the president, or trying to follow him anyway. But this is what they had to say. People have begun to realize that Mr. Biden spent 40% of his first term on vacation. This according to hotair.com, always an interesting site, they say. Perhaps it shouldn't be all that surprising that an election in 2020 that featured an unprecedented number of absentee ballots has produced an absentee president. But that's apparently what we have now in the United States, and the numbers don't lie. The Republican National Committee is quickly moving to highlight this data during their final push towards the midterm, and Joe Biden's attendance record is on par with a perpetually absent high school student. Again, this is coming from hotair.com. Out of the 589 days since being sworn in, Biden has spent 234 of them either on vacation or on leisure trips having nothing to do with his official duty. This is according to the Republican National Committee. And also they note that 70% of those days were spent at his mansion in Delaware. And they say also that's the same residence where a $500,000 border wall is being erected at taxpayer expense.
Glad we got one somewhere.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, unlike our country's southern border. So that's work there by the hotair.com and the Republican National Committee.
You know, depending on what media outlet you pay attention to, you'll find that the president's approval numbers are soaringly high or miserably low. Which is it?
Let's talk about miserably low. I mean, this particular poll, and again, I apologize, it's early in the morning with all these numbers, but they're pretty interesting. This is coming from CBS News. How about that? And they released this poll this week. It was a poll of 2,126 registered U.S. voters. And here we go. 65% disapprove of the way Biden is handling inflation. 60% disapprove of the way he's handling the economy. 60% disapprove of the way he's handling gas prices. 60% disapprove of the way he's handling gun policy. 58% disapprove of the way he is handling crime in the United States. Another 58% disapprove of the way he is handling the issue of abortion. 55% disapprove of the way he's handling issues of climate change. And last but not least, 54% disapprove of the way he is handling the situation with Russia and Ukraine. Again, that's coming from CBS. That's a poll of 2,126 registered U.S. voters conducted August 24 through 26. So that's just one of the polls that's out there, Rick. Not so promising.
Well, we saw the anniversary of the Afghanistan debacle, and interesting the way the media covered it. I was thinking, gee, if this had been Donald Trump's mistake, how would it have been covered?
Oh, my gosh, you're so right about that. And our good pals over at newsbusters.org, that's a very capable conservative press watchdog, most notably Scott Whitlock. He's a research director over there. And they did a massive study of the coverage, of the kind of coverage that Biden got during the entire Afghanistan series of events. And I'll just give you a couple of for instances there. They note that during the month of August 2021, there was a heavy network evening newscast of the disaster, 409 minutes. And but by July of 2022, ABC, CBS, and NBC, they allowed only 7 seconds of coverage. This is true. This is, again, coming from Newsbusters. They analyzed the amount of coverage that were seen on the primary news at night on ABC, CBS, and NBC. So it started out with 409 minutes, but as things fell to pieces, in July, they gave it 7 seconds of coverage. And according to Mr. Whitlock, he says the fall in the amount of coverage was quick and steep. August 2021's total of 409 minutes fell to 92 minutes in September, 16 minutes in October. By November, World News Tonight, CBS Evening News, and the NBC Nightly News managed just over 10 minutes of coverage of the ongoing disaster. And he said that the scanty amount of coverage continued to trend downward through the spring and summer of 2022, dropping to a shocking low of 7 seconds total in July. So that's another one of these things where you're wondering if the media is covering for the president, and along comes our buds over there at newsbusters.org to tell you the numbers and show you that's happening.
We're seeing a lot of labels when it comes to political parties, political persuasions, who you follow. And the president certainly laid some labels out on his opposition, but how do people, when you look at the poll numbers and the research and things like that, how many people really label themselves?
Man, that's a wonderful way to put it, Rick. You hit the nail right on the head, and certainly that speech goes down as one of the most name-dropping speeches, anyway, of the year. But moving right along, here we go with another poll, so hang on there, ladies and gentlemen. This is coming from NBC News, and this is a poll of 1,000 registered U.S. voters conducted right here in August and released on Sunday. And here's the big takeaway. Only 3% of U.S. voters say that their political identity is the most important thing about them. I repeat, only 3% agreed with that. 15% said their political identity is not at all important. And 19% said it's not too important. And 25% admitted that their political identity is very important when thinking about their personal identity. And another 38% of voters said their political identity is somewhat important. So the takeaway message here is that I think a lot of our analysts need to take into account that hammering on politics in White House might want to listen to all the time may not resonate with people, because after all, only 3% say that their political identity is the most important thing about them.
And while you're on the topic, how about people kind of identifying as liberals these days?
Yeah, well, here's some more numbers for you. Good morning, everyone. Anyway, we're going to go back to that same NBC News survey. It was a pretty capable thing. And it finds that conservative beliefs are actually dominating the public's ideological mindset of the moment. And here's some straightforward, pretty simple numbers this morning. Something for all the political strategists who are reading the tea leaves out there to think about. 34% of registered U.S. voters consider themselves to be moderate. But wait, 21% say they are very conservative. 18% say they are somewhat conservative. So you do the math, and that's a pretty happy group that say they're conservatives. Meanwhile, 13% say they are very liberal. 12% say they are somewhat liberal. And the rest, 2%, they don't know what they are. So the takeaway on that is only 25% of U.S. voters truly identify as liberals. So something for everybody to think about, perhaps.
So for aviation buffs, you know, that in the World Wars they would stamp the flag of the opposing country on the side of the aircraft every time they shot one down. And I understand that Greg Gutfeld is now stamping Stephen Colbert, Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel, Don Lemon, and everybody on the side of his plane.
Isn't that something? This news came out this week. It's very interesting. I do cover Fox News because I think they do a very interesting job in presenting the news, and that shows in the ratings as well. I have a little item in the Inside the Beltway column called Foxified. About once a week, we take a peek at how they're doing. Here's how they're doing. Fox News finished the month of August as the third most network in the entire television kingdom. We're talking about everybody. And they outpaced ABC and also all the other programming that you see. This is all according to Nielsen Media Research. And they say that Fox News is also marking the 19th month in a row that they have bested their cable news rivals, that's MSNBC and CNN, and they also aired 96 of the top cable news telecasts for the month. Think about that, 96 out of 100. So they must be doing something right. But anyway, let's look at the overall numbers. Fox News drew an average of 2.4 million primetime viewers last week. MSNBC had 1.3 million, and CNN had 733,000. But, as you mentioned, late-night host Greg Gutfeld, now he had an audience of 2,191,000 viewers. And guess what? As you said, he beat every other late-night host. He's the king now, including Stephen and everyone else on the network shows. They do have the backing of being a network show, but he's done it. So Greg Gutfeld, most watched late night guy of all, with his audience of 2.2 million viewers.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you, and have a good holiday, everybody.
Let's hope so. It is 6:45. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. We'll talk with Jim Trustee next. Of course, he is a member of former President Trump's legal team, and he is also an expert in analyzing the numerous legal cases of the day. That is next. But first, Albie Dees in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In D.C. on 295, 395, and 695, plus the tunnels and bridges, everything is clear and at speed. It's kind of quiet. Now, on the Virginia side of the Beltway, I just checked out the traffic cameras. No crashes or construction on the inner loop or on the outer loop. On 66 in Fairfax County, you're not tapping the brakes on the eastbound side or on the westbound side. And on 95 in Virginia, between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, central cruise control lanes are wide open, both northbound and southbound. And now, from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly sunny, hot, and more humid. The start of the Labor Day weekend. Highs today around the 90-degree mark. We'll have some filtered sunshine at times, and definitely you'll notice that added mugginess. Lows back in the 60s and 70s tonight under partly cloudy skies for your Sunday. Partly sunny, again hot and humid. Highs near 90 degrees. Can't rule out a stray storm, mainly into the mountains. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the First Alert Weather Center.
70 degrees in the nation's capital, 646 on the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
News Talk 105.9.
WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is a Saturday morning update. Jim Trusty joins us, partner at IFRA Law, and he's the former chief of the Organized Crime and Gang Section at the U.S. Department of Justice. And Jim's been with us over the past 4 years or so on the show. And, you know, kind of a mild manner, scholarly guy, behind-the-scenes kind of guy, and all of a sudden he's front and center with the paparazzi following him to his SUV with their cameras. Jim, thanks for taking the time to be with us this morning.
Happy to do it, and happy to not have paparazzi in between you and I.
Well, walk us through the week for people that haven't been able to follow it that closely, and just if you can kind of walk through the facts and the process.
Sure. Well, what we have pending before the court in West Palm Beach, Florida, in federal court, is a motion to appoint a special master. And the motion is designed to essentially get some measure of judicial oversight into the process of reviewing the documents seized from the Mar-a-Lago home of the president. And you know, right now, if you don't have that kind of intervention, you're left to the Department of Justice just kind of telling you, this is what we found, this is what we think is subject to privilege. They make all the internal determinations, and as a defense attorney, or in this case as a plaintiff's attorney, we sit back and have to just wait and see what they say. We're not comfortable with that approach here, and we went to the court and filed a motion for a special master, which would be someone like essentially either a retired judge or a very well-experienced attorney that would oversee the process of exchanging information, of allowing us to review the materials, and making some determinations that would help the court eventually as to whether or not certain things were privileged, whether they were subject to executive privilege, whether they might be presidential or personal under the Presidential Records Act. I mean, there's all sorts of classifications that they could help with, and it would really tee up a lot of the future litigation that we're trying to pursue. So that court ordered the government to file a paper responding to our motion on Tuesday. We got that at just about midnight Tuesday night and spent some time reviewing it and then hunkered down Wednesday to do our reply to that, again, on this issue of the special master. They had filed a 36-page paper, so we had some homework, and we spent a long day Wednesday getting our thoughts together and then filing our reply and pointing out what we think was wrong about some of the government's arguments. And then that all led to oral argument in front of Judge Cannon from the Southern District of Florida on Thursday afternoon at about 1. And you're right, there was a lot of press, people that were just shouting crazy things and shoving. I saw one cameraman's sneaker fly off. It was kind of crazy, chaotic stuff. But the hearing itself was respectful and took about an hour and a half, and the court was firmly in control. The judge, you know, was very active, had lots of questions for both sides. And she indicated at the end that she was going to take it under advisement and issue a ruling in writing in the near future. And she's been very expeditious on this case so far. She's moved quickly. I think we had a Saturday ruling last week that told us what the briefing schedule was. So I think we will see something in days, not weeks, in terms of her decision on this idea of the special master. And that's going to help us pursue, you know, our rights for the president for some period of time, I think.
Well, Jim, I know you have a lot coming up in the weeks ahead, and you will be speaking through court filings and in the courtroom, and we will be looking forward to getting updates from you as that proceeds.
Will do.
Well, there's another high-profile case that has originated out of Florida, and you've been watching it very closely over the past several months and some major developments this week.
Yeah, this is the case of Ashley Biden's diary, the president's daughter, and it's been a very bizarre road. It began with two Florida residents. It ended up in Manhattan, and it's going to be probably sprawled around some of the newspaper headlines for a little while. This story started with Ashley Biden moving out of a friend's house in Delray Beach, Florida, in the spring of 2020. By agreement with that old roommate, she left some property behind, and a new woman moved into the house and eventually found Ashley's property. Well, that woman felt it was an opportunity to make some money because, in part, she had found a diary with some details of Ashley's upbringing. She and a good friend decided that they could make some money off of this, and she originally tried to sell the diary to the Trump campaign, and the Trump campaign wouldn't have anything to do with it, so she turned to Project Veritas, and she ended up selling the diary to Project Veritas for $40,000. And you'll remember, I think we talked about it a few months ago, how federal agents raided the headquarters of Project Veritas looking for not even the diary, but notes on the phones of the people that work at that truth organization. So it's been kind of a crazy ride. They had two people plead guilty in Manhattan this week to interstate transportation of stolen property or conspiracy to commit that offense, I suppose. Their sentencing is set for December 6th. But there's really two things that I think are kind of fascinating or at least intriguing about this case. The first is there's not even a plea agreement on the record, which is kind of strange. In federal court, when you look at the docket entries, you end up seeing the agreement. I was curious to see what sorts of concessions the government made, if they were going to recommend probation for this very small dollar case. And there's nothing there. So that's a little bit of a red flag or maybe a yellow flag as to what the heck is going on with this prosecution. But the bigger point that I would make about it is it's an exceptional case for federal prosecutors to take. Remember, any sort of theft case has the potential to be handled in state court if it's going to be prosecuted, and some of them end up just being civil suits. But in this case, the feds in Manhattan, which is a pretty political office overall, decided to take a case with a cash value, which is kind of the driver in their decision-making, of only $40,000. I can tell you most offices, even Maryland back when I was an assistant U.S. attorney, had a threshold of $1 million. You know, you had to have a dispute or a loss or an attempted loss that was in the neighborhood of $1 million or more to justify taking that federal case. And by now, with inflation, maybe it's $5 million. But either way, a place like Manhattan typically is not going to take small dollar cases. So they've made an exception in this case. They've federalized a case that almost never would show up in federal court. And again, it's about a diary that affects the Biden family. And I suppose the prosecution, the unintended consequence of that prosecution, is they seemingly are validating that it's the real thing, that it's her diary and that it's politically harmful. So we'll keep an eye on the sentencing, see if plea agreements show up. But it's an unusual use of federal resources to prosecute a stolen diary.
Very troubling story out of Pennsylvania involving a member of the judiciary.
Yeah, this is really a tragic and kind of horrifying corruption story. There was a judge in Luzerne County, Common Pleas in Pennsylvania, by the name of Mark Civarella, and he also worked with a man named Michael Conahan, not a judge, but somebody who was in the business of establishing private detention facilities. And this judge, basically, as part of a kickback scheme, lobbied to tear down the existing Pennsylvania institutions for juveniles and then rebuild it with his friend, Mr. Conahan, and he received payouts to the tune of $2.7 million for facilitating that. And the incentives in terms of the use of this for-profit detention center, the incentive was to put juveniles in that facility, which he did with reckless abandon over a period of years. And this goes back a number of years. There was a criminal prosecution of the judge that went back to 2011, where he was convicted for RICO and received 28 years. The man associated with the institutions, building the institutions, also got 17 and a half years. But there's been a long-winding civil lawsuit with 282 plaintiffs being juveniles and 32 parents filing suit and litigating the case in front of a federal judge who this week ordered $206 million in restitution to the victims. And so, you know, corruption's nothing new. I mean, you have stories of lawyers and judges that engage in corruption, but the details of this case really can make you kind of heartsick. I mean, what he was doing was locking up children for some of the most minor things you could imagine. There was 282 kids, now adults, that testified in the case. There was a 14-year-old who was in trouble for underage drinking, a citation, And the judge says, if you like to drink like the Bulldogs, you can be locked up like them too. Wouldn't let her hug her mother on the way out of the court into juvenile detention. You had another kid who was driving without a license, and the judge looked at her and said, count the buttons on your blouse. That's the number of months you're going away for. So there's a real sadistic streak. It wasn't just corruption. It was sadistic. And of the 282 kids that testified, 79 were under age 13 at the time he put them in the detention facility. And there was a kid who testified he was locked up by this judge at age 8, with some of the offenses being smoking on school property, stealing candy, and jaywalking. And sadly, and maybe predictably, part of the story and part of the reason for the high dollar damages was that some of these kids suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, depression. Some talked about contemplating suicide. And so this was, as the judge called it, there were human casualties of a scandal of epic proportions. And the judge essentially apologized that he knew that even $200 million didn't really restore the harm caused by this corrupt judge. But what a story. I mean, at the end of the day, just a horrific story. But again, at least some measure of justice this week when another judge looked down at these corrupt individuals who are serving federal sentences and added restitution to the pot.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. Jim, thank you for the perspectives because you find these fascinating legal cases and always give us such a great insight. Jim, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. They're worth talking about, and I appreciate the forum.
It is 6:58. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. John Gizzi coming up. We'll talk with Gordon Chang. We've also got Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer and KT McFarland all on the way.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9. WMAL.